Today's deteriorating economic situation in our country is a legacy of the U.S. invasion, because the U.S. never let Afghan national economic bodies grow or become self-sufficient. All the U.S. did was to keep Afghanistan a consumer country and dependent on U.S. aid. Likewise, after the withdrawal, the U.S. seized Afghanistan's assets and cut international funding. As a result, the U.S. is to blame for Afghanistan's fragile economy.
In the meantime, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has announced that 25 million people in Afghanistan are living in poverty, and 19 million people are facing food insecurity.
Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres arrived in Pakistan to see climate-induced devastation from months of deadly record floods that have left 500,000 people living in tents under the open sky and have left nearly 1,400 deaths. During his visit, the UN chief and Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif discussed the latest situation in the country. The two focused on joint efforts to carry out relief, rescue, and rehabilitation at the international level to mitigate the sufferings of the flood-affected people. Later, the visiting UN chief also met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and assured him of every support possible. The UN Secretary General, who has launched a global appeal to raise $160 million in flood assistance for Pakistan, says Pakistan is one of the countries most affected by climate change in recent months.
Developed countries must step up and provide Pakistan and other countries on the front lines with the financial and technical resources they need to survive extreme weather events like these deadly floods.
Bhutto said that his government is trying its best to help people who had lost everything in floods, but international help would be required to overcome the catastrophe.
I cannot shelter 33 million families. I cannot provide the food and clothing for 35 million families. We don't have the infrastructure in place. And this is just the rescue and relief phase.
The UN chief will travel to areas most impacted by the climate catastrophe. He will interact with the displaced families and oversee the UN's humanitarian response and relief efforts for millions of affected people.
As the floods continue to ravage Pakistan, UN agencies and several countries continue to send aid to flood-affected people in recent weeks. However, Pakistani authorities believe that more assistance is required to help millions of flood victims. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next two economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2% and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A rally has been held in the besieged Gaza Strip to show support for Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds against the growing Israeli aggressions. Protesters have chanted slogans against the Israeli regime and called for an end to the Israeli occupation. Tensions have soared in Al-Quds in recent weeks as extremist Israeli settlers backed by Israeli forces desecrated Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against committing violations in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque will not be tolerated by the Palestinian people. Our people will defend Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque with all means. Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line that must not be crossed.
People have come out to reiterate their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against the Israeli attacks. Al-Quds is a holy region of significant importance for all Muslims around the world.
Palestinian resistance groups will defend Al-Quds and will always be a safety valve to protect our people. Armed resistance is the key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
This protest is sending a strong message to the whole world that Gaza will not sit idly while Al-Quds is being desecrated. Al-Quds is the eternal capital of Palestine. We also want to condemn the daily killing of our people in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces and the construction of illegal settlements as well as home demolitions.
Since the Israeli occupation of Al-Quds in 1967, the city and Al-Aqsa Mosque have been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice. Palestinians in the blockaded coastal territory say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Britain has a new monarch. King Charles III used his first address to the nation since taking the throne to pay tribute to his late mother.
Queen Elizabeth was a life well lived, a promise with destiny kept, and she is mourned most deeply in her passing. That promise of lifelong service I renew to you all today.
Earlier, the new king, alongside Queen Consort Camilla, met well-wishers gathered outside Buckingham Palace, paying their respects after the passing of Queen Elizabeth II on Thursday. Gun salutes, floral tributes, and flags flying at half-mast symbolized the country in the first phase of an official 12-day mourning period. Messages of condolences flooded in from world leaders, with domestic tributes being led in the House of Commons by the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss.
Today, we show the world that we do not fear what lies ahead. We send our deepest sympathy to all members of the royal family. We pay tribute to our late Queen, and we offer loyal service to our new King.
These are unprecedented times, and the parliamentarians will be getting used to saying God save the king instead of God save the queen. But what will a monarchy under the stewardship of Charles III really look like? Charles's ascension to the throne comes following a 7-decade-long reign by the late monarch.
Lots of people who maybe were not great fans of the monarchy as an institution respected Queen Elizabeth II for her longevity, for her record. They forgot many of the things that she was also associated with, the end of empire, which is often very brutal in places like Kenya. But they gave her some respect, and you'll see that, I think, over the next 12 days. You'll see people prepared to give that respect to the Queen. I think it's going to be a very different story going down the road, and we should remember that the monarchy is very important to the British elite. The armed forces, the security services, judiciary, they swear loyalty not to Parliament, but to the monarchy.
Charles's new role as king comes at not just a tumultuous time for the throne, but for the country itself.
If he's going to be an effective king, he will have to speak to the nation in a way that brings people together. And that may involve him, and as Charles has known to do this in the past, be a very much more politically overtly political monarch than some of his predecessors. He's made interventions on various issues, and I think he'll continue to do that going forward.
At home and abroad, there are questions about what Britain's new monarch's vision will be. Will the tentacles of the new reign bring forth a new dawn? Former subjects across the world will simply wait and see. Amina Taylor, London.
A shroud of terror has descended onto the streets of Leicester, with Muslim residents of the English town living in fear for their very safety. Racism, cricket hooliganism, and violent street assaults, all targeting Muslims of mostly Pakistani origin, has become commonplace in this once peaceful city. Amid the hate crime spike, Press TV was informed by concerned locals that the attacks appear to be conducted by Hindu thugs radicalized by foreign extremism.
At this stage, we cannot verify the political affiliations of the perpetrators. However, speaking to local Muslim residents, they've expressed major concerns that what might be inspiring this latest round of attacks could be Hindutva supremacism from India. The rise of anti-Muslim violence taking place over there could have a ripple effect affecting the Indian diaspora community, particularly here in the UK, which boasts a sizable British Indian community.
Hindutva has become a significant ideology inside India, seeking to establish Hindu hegemony over the country. Many of its advocates preach intolerance towards rival religious groups, especially Muslims, who've become a prime target of India's Hindu extremist rhetoric. Local activists informed us that they believe it's the same Hindutva hate which has caused the rise in Islamophobia here in Britain.
The Muslims and the Hindus in Leicester have been getting along for decades. We've not had no issues. It's these latest crowds of these young Hindutva ideology thugs, RSS, the BJP thugs. This mentality, they come with this mentality, they're trying to bring it down here, and they're very, very racist, and they're the ones who are causing the problems in the community.
This year, at least three severe attacks have occurred, with at least two victims being hospitalised. The media has so far only focused on a recent outpouring of anger by local Muslims, venting their frustrations via scuffles with the police on Monday night. But if the alleged problem of Hindu radicalism isn't dealt with soon, Muslim vigilantism may become the go-to option for some furious locals. Robert Carter, Leicester.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
in the limelight.
The racist roots of American and European universities are being exposed and their nasty implications in human misery publicized for the whole world to see, says Hamid Debashi, author, in an article published under the heading, Western Universities Struggle to Grow Away from Their Racist Roots. Stay tuned for more. Last April, Harvard President Larry Baikow released the report of the Committee on Harvard and Legacy of Slavery, accepted the committee's recommendations in full, and announced a historic commitment of $100 million to fund their implementation, according to a detailed internal report on the school's four-century connection to slavery. This seems to be a season of public penance for American universities as they come to terms with nasty skeletons in their closets. How can a university muster the moral authority to teach anyone anything with that kind of horrid past? The report by a committee of Harvard faculty members is Harvard's effort to begin redressing the wrongs of the past, as some other universities have been doing for decades, according to an article in the New York Times. But how exactly is this redressing to be done? When people heard John Henry Newman's lofty ideas in 1850s, later collected in the volume The Idea of a University, they might be forgiven for thinking that Europeans and Americans were truly engaged in the perfection of the human soul, and that universities were a place to cultivate young people for an upright moral life. Really? Enslaved men and women served Harvard presidents and professors in fed and cared for Harvard students, the Harvard report reveals. Was that evidence of Newman's ideas reaching the New World? The racist roots of American and European universities are being exposed and their nasty implications in human misery publicized for the whole world to see. This is not a cause for jubilation or even for a sigh of relief that truth is finally triumphing. This is a moment for reflection and an opportunity for remedy. The structural issues such as reports that expose for the next generations of higher education. At least since the reflections of the towering Italian thinker Antonio Gramsci, we have known that education is a solid source of cultural hegemony of the ruling class. But the relatively widespread availability of higher education and the attraction of a global body of students to US and European universities has demographically altered their compositions. A much larger and more diverse body of students, faculty, and administration is now attentive to the roots and fruits of these universities. This cycle of soul-searching began some two decades ago with Brown University examining its roots in slavery. Soon afterwards, Harvard College acknowledged it had relied on slave labor, and Princeton University admitted to holding a slave auction in 1766. At University of Columbia, sons of merchants involved in the slave trade were enrolled, while Dartmouth College admitted that at one time there had been arguably as many enslaved black people as there were students. death was at a time when University of Pennsylvania faculty and alumni were actively involved in framing the Constitution to support slavery. European universities were not exempt. Oxford began probing its own role in British colonialism in 2019, in what The Guardian described as a pioneering effort to crowdsource and decolonize its own imperialist part. This led to the establishment of an informative website detailing the history of Oxford's racist roots in slavery and colonialism. These events at Oxford started with a student-led movement that originated in South Africa called Rhodes Must Fall, a reference to Cecil Rhodes, Oxford's imperialist benefactor. But Oxford ultimately decided to keep its Rhodes statue intact because it would have been too expensive to remove it. Other UK universities are equally implicated. The University of Glasgow admitted it had received more than $258 million from people who derived their wealth from slavery, while the University of Bristol estimated that 85% of the wealth used to found the university depended on slave labor, according to Reuters. On both sides of the Atlantic, U.S. and European universities were founded on the profits made from transatlantic slave trade and the lucrative business of colonialism. In these universities, the children of slave traders and colonial officers were educated, and indeed indoctrinated, in the validity of their conquest and in the political culture and moral depravity that sustained this Sikh tradition. What do we do now? Admitting mea culpa is, of course, necessary but not sufficient. Revelations that top American and universities in the Europe were heavily invested in slavery, benefited from the slave trade, and were institutional advocates of colonialism is a major event in the history of higher education. But what exactly needs to be done once such revelations are widely publicized? Allocation of resources to diversify the student and faculty body to include the descendants of the impoverished, robbed, and denigrated communities, Black people, Native Americans, Latins, and students and faculty from across the colonial world is, of course, an absolute must. While Western universities are today quite cognizant of the disenfranchised communities in their midst and seek to recruit more from these communities, this does not apply to students from around the world subject to their colonial and imperial violence. This is a serious shortcoming. Students and scholars from Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where the EU and US have been definitive to their national miseries, must be given particular attention. Today, Afghan and Iraqi students in particular need to be given financial resources for their higher education in American and European universities. But what exactly are these students and scholars to study or teach in these universities? Further indoctrination in white supremacist curricula. The urgent task of remedying the horrors of the past must include serious reconsideration of the future of college curricula. Meaningful reparations can only occur when the history of racism, slavery, and colonialism is brought to the forefront inside European and American university classrooms. But today, even the body of scholarship produced under the rubric of critical race theory or intersectionality is under attack by reactionary forces in Europe and the US. Private universities, at the mercy of political pressure, could never lead the way, except within the conservative context determined by their wealthy donors, which continue to oppose any serious curricular changes. This is where the global media is an equally, if not even more, changes. This is where the global media is an equal, if not even more crucial, public sphere where such changes can be inaugurated. Consider when the New York Times launched two crucial projects, the 1619 Project on the history of slavery and the Haiti Ransom Project on French colonialism in Haiti. To be sure, these two seminal projects are based on generations of scholarship. But such a scholarship does not easily translate into curricular changes. Western civilization continues to be the code word for the sustained indoctrination of successive generations of students who are kept critically unaware, not just of other civilizations, but also of the troubling origins of civilizational thinking. Nothing enduring or significant follows so long as we have curricular apartheid in the world. With Western civilization receiving preferential treatment and enormous resources, while other civilizations, cultures, and accompanying suffering are delegated to the poorly financed periphery. Today, issues of environmental justice, mass refugees, labor migration, and the organically changing character of world cultures are far more crucial to understand than a fake and forced emphasis on Western civilization. Today, the most racist white supremacist political movements are sustained and agitated by false assumptions about the uniqueness and superiority of Western civilization, to which elite universities remain committed. There is no redressing the sustained history of U.S. and European universities' involvement with the slavery, racism, and colonialism without first dismantling its sustained ideological premise.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesley. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
De-dollarization is discussed more and more these days, especially since the conflict in Ukraine broke out. But this process has been ongoing for quite some time, especially when it comes to sanctioned-hit countries like Iran, Russia, and China in particular. Well, the Russian president has said that de-dollarization of the world economy is inevitable. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how feasible this approach is and whether there really is a chance for world countries to be freed from the dollar's political arm, specifically one in which the U.S. has used as a weapon. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Political analyst and journalist at the Convo Couch, Fiorella Isabel, joins us from Moscow. Also joining us is former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who joins us from Raleigh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both. Let's take a look first and put our attention to you, Fiorella Isabel, and what the Russian President Vladimir Putin has said, that the process of de-dollarization of the global economy is inevitable. The question comes about, we've heard that before. And at this point, what about the when of this process, and how can we see that happen in layman terms, if you can?
Right. So what we're seeing is the collapse of the EU. We're seeing the collapse of the euro. We're seeing these sanctions that have consequences more on those who are imposing them than on Russia. These sanctions have essentially destroyed the European economy. And the United States, of course, doesn't seem to care very much about that. The United States defense industry and the elite of the United States are fine. But their own country is lacking in infrastructure, and in a lot of just domestic issues are coming to a really huge issue. So Russia has other markets that they're looking at. They're looking at China. They're looking at India. They're looking at Pakistan. They're getting closer with an economic relationship to Latin America, closer to African nations as well. And so what we're seeing is this shift towards a multipolar world, where the United States no longer calls the shots, where the West no longer calls the shots. And so the sanctions are actually not hurting Russia as intended. In fact, Russia has been able to bounce back rather quickly. The economy, the ruble, has been extremely high, I think the highest that any other currency has in terms of the bounce back. And the right now, with the coming winter, we're seeing that Russia will be fine when it comes to gas, when it comes to, in spite of some inflation, Russia's energy is secure. Whereas if you compare that to the EU and the UK, there's a completely different situation going on. And I think that's where we're headed.
Well, a top economic advisor to the Russian President Vladimir Putin, Ray McGovern, has said that aside from China and Russia avoiding using the dollar, is that it will minimize Washington's ability to bully other countries into following, I guess, the U.S. rules or the Western rules. And they have done that with the threat of sanctions, obviously. Do you think that that will happen, Ray McGovern?
Oh, you tricked me. Well, I think it's inevitable, not in the short run, but over the longer term. What we have is a situation where the Ukraine war and the economic sanctions have caused a tectonic shift in what the world looked like just a year ago. We have the lily-white West on the one hand, and then we have everybody else, mostly people of color, on the other hand. China, India, Russia has been so blackened that it's become a people of color. The list goes on. So you have a small minority that used to dominate things no longer able to do that. And I think as winter comes on and the Europeans realize that, you know, following U.S. diktat like lemmings can get us into a lot of trouble and even can make us freeze to death. So there's time before the winter's onslaught to work out a sensible arrangement where in addition to lifting some of these stupid sanctions that were never going to work, in response to that, allowing the Europeans to get through the winter with enough natural gas and oil so that they can deal with this stuff once spring comes. Now, the thing in the war in Ukraine, of course, is very crucial to this. But no reputable military analyst, and I used to be one of them in my day when I served as an Army intelligence officer, no responsible person will predict that Ukraine will win this war. What's in store is protracted grief for both sides, mm-hmm. as long as NATO goads the Ukrainians on. And as my co-guest just said, the U.S. doesn't seem to care much about that, nor does the U.S. seem to care much about being warm during the wintertime.
Sure.
Or does the West seem to care about the possibility of a new Chernobyl right there in Zaporozhye in the middle of Ukraine? Don't the Western politicians realize what that could mean and how the U.S. would accept that blithely with Victoria Nuland in Kiev saying,
indeed.
Keep shelling Zaporozhye.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned there, Fiorella Isabel, is about Russian energy resources, in particular, obviously, gas and oil being at the top of that list. Now, here's what's interesting about how Ray McGovern says the West doesn't seem to realize or doesn't seem to care, I think is how he worded that. Why doesn't the West care when you look at the countries like Russia, Iran, Venezuela, and China, where cumulatively we're talking about 40% of the world's energy in the hands of these countries? Shouldn't the U.S. and the West care about how this divergence from the dollar or de-dollarization, as we have stated, were these countries, which they are moving away from it, would affect the standing of the dollar and hence all the repercussions from that in terms of how it would impact the U.S. economy? Don't they realize that that's what's going to happen?
Well, so there's a couple of things here. That's been the talk. Why does the United States and the West not seem to care? I think Germans seem to care, right? They're out there protesting. People in the Czech Republic have been protesting against NATO and against these sanctions on Russia because they know it's hurting their economy. I think that the working people care, but the people in power are in some ways benefiting from this. The U.S. defense industry has skyrocketed. They're making a literal killing off of this. And so the United States seems to be bullying the EU into imposing these sanctions on Russia against to their own detriment, essentially. And so what's been the talk lately came from this report from RAND Corporation that basically outlined that the United States was pushing to destroy the German economy, because let's remember that Germany is extremely vulnerable to these sanctions because they depend largely on cheap gas from Russia. And so this is a suicidal mission for Germany. And in that report, it basically said, well, if we, in order to continue this sort of political ploy, then Germany would have to impose sanctions on Russia. And of course, it will sink its economy. And then to a greater extent, it will affect the economy of the EU. But this is a way to eliminate one of its competitors. Now, it's interesting because Germany and you know, nations in the EU, particularly obviously the NATO nations, are huge allies of the West. So it seems to me, and this is what so many are analyzing right now, is that this is a sort of controlled demolition of the economy to achieve a political purpose. And they do not care because the people pushing this sort of thing are still making out sure. with a lot of money. So indeed. That's essentially what's being talked about right now, because otherwise it doesn't really make any logical sense that they would be pushing this to their own detriment.
Well, we need to talk about this a little bit more, even though it may be going off the subject somewhat, Ray McGovern, but to expand more about what our guest there, Fiorella Isabel, said, I'm looking at a headline of which it should really open the eyes of many, and that's how energy traders are making a killing exporting U.S. natural gas, $200 million for each single shipment, of which basically the sale of U.S. gas, liquefied natural gas, has gone up to 60%, increased that is to 60%, up from less than 20% this time a year ago. So we can see that being one of the few ways that the U.S. is profiting from this war. It seems like the U.S. is actually after this particular way of profiting off the war, the gas issue, energy, and of course the military sales.
Well, I appreciate Fiorella's analysis of this, and she could well be right. What I have to hearken back to is what I call the recklessness and the fecklessness of our foreign policy leaders. Now, I refer specifically to Blinken and his counterpart in Germany, Baerbock. They don't seem to know which end is up. They are very poorly advising the German government and the German people. And, you know, it seems to me that this, where money is always important, whether the U.S. is doing this deliberately and Baerbock is just too dumb to realize it, to tank the German economy, that presumes an imagination and a competence that I don't think exists in Washington or with Baerbock. Now, when I said before, I hope I didn't say the West doesn't care much about the effects of the sanctions. I tried to say the U.S. doesn't, because we're kind of immune. We're going to be warm this winter. And if the new Chernobyl, if Zaporizhia blows because of shelling by the Ukrainians, the U.S. will be sitting pretty. There'll be a big problem in Europe, not just in Ukraine, but this helps me to understand why someone like Victoria Nuland, the Deputy Secretary of State, can go to Kiev, chutzpah personified. She's the one that caused the coup in Kiev on February 22nd, 2014. She goes back to Kiev, and next thing you know, we have a big, very big offensive, and they're still shelling Zaporizhia. UN comes in, and this is a teaching point here. Can you depend on the UN? I'm sorry. You can't depend on the IAEA. Rafael Grossi goes down there, and the shelling comes in, and he can't figure out which direction it's coming from. Give me a break. He says, we can't judge which direction it's coming from. We thank the Russians for protecting us from these projectiles, but we have to do something about this, but we don't know who's doing the shelling. Come on, give me a break. Now, my point is simply this. It used to be we could depend on the IAEA. Back 20 years ago, when Bush and Cheney wanted to make war on Iraq, I remember El Baradei, the head of the IAEA, saying very solemnly before the UN Security Council, the reports of these yellow cake uranium from Africa are not confirmed, are not, what was the word he used? Not authentic. In other words, they were made up. So since El Baradei retired, there have been a succession of people in charge of the IAEA who passed muster in Washington. Amano is another one, his direct successor. Sure. He thanked, we have the cable in which he thanked the Americans for putting him in office, and he asked for new money for put new drapes in his office. That's a bit, we got that from WikiLeaks. So The problem is, where can the Russians turn to get a fair reading on what's going on at this critical place, the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe? They can't turn anywhere to get an unvarnished view of from which direction the shelling is coming.
Well, to go back to what we were talking about, the whole notion of de-dollarization Fiona Isabel, what we are looking at to have speeded this up in the context of the Ukraine conflict is when the U.S. and the West in particular, or cumulatively, froze Russia's roughly $640 billion of their assets in the foreign currency reserves due to the U.S. sanctions. that made countries around the world basically wake up. It was a wake-up call because they said, well, if we don't follow U.S. foreign policy, we could be next. Do you think then, and we have Saudi Arabia that actually began thinking about selling its oil based on the yuan. Israel even, for the first time, added China's yuan to its currency in a reshuffle that's not happened in a decade. So are we looking at countries then de-dollarizing because of that and therefore the dollar to take a hit from it?
I think the dollar is already taking a hit in those terms, right? I don't think I agree with Ray McGovern. I don't think it's going to happen right away. I think it's on its way to happening. I think it will allow for a more level playing field. And the reason I think these countries are doing that is because less of an ideological reason. I think for the most part, it's more of where they see the wind blowing, right? Like there is an economic shift right now that, like never before. And Russia standing up to the expansion of NATO and Russia bouncing back and being extremely just resilient with how they've done this with, you know, the exit of, say, like these corporations like Starbucks, McDonald's. They've reinvented these sort of corporations into a Russian based type of company where people can still keep their jobs. And that sort of resilience has resonated with many people who have found that, hey, we have all been under the boot of the U.S. empire. So now we have these opportunities to maybe perhaps build our relationships with areas that we really haven't been looking at, which is why you've been seeing, you know, Russia go in there. You saw Lavrov be received with open arms in Africa, where, of course, they talked about the USSR helping to decolonize several of these nations, whereas Blinken was not received that warmly at all. And then, of course, you see the United States poking the dragon with China as well, and via Taiwan with Pelosi's visit. So you see this sort of the economics is following the actions of militarily of the United States, NATO, and the West are and Russia closer together, are pushing Iran closer to that relationship, are pushing African nations closer to dealing with their neighbors in the East and Latin America. Of course, they're pushing all these nations together that have one thing in common, and that is the years and decades of being under the U.S. hegemony, right? And so they're looking for ways to no longer go back to that. And it's, again, more economic-based than ideological. So I do think we're heading in that direction where the dollar will no longer be the... But I think that's going to be more so on China rather than Russia. I do think that, like I said, it's going to be multiple choices. And of course, Russia is looking to the East or looking to Africa. They don't necessarily United States anymore. And they're making that very clear by refusing these price caps on the gas, right? And saying, sure, we're not going to do that at all.
Well, we're going to talk about other countries, in particular China, in the context of BRICS. But before we get to that, because our guest Ray McGovern there is in the U.S., Ray McGovern, economically and somewhat technically speaking, the dollar crisis scenario, based on the definition of it, is said that what would cause a sudden crisis for the dollar is when there's the dual threat of high inflation and high debt. Now, the U.S. is plagued by those two factors, isn't it? If I'm incorrect, please let me know. That's a scenario where rising consumer prices force the Fed to raise the interest rates, something that it has done. Are we looking at these two, the debt and the inflation, causing the crisis, or has it done it already?
Well, it's on its way. It's well on its way. The question is whether policymakers in Washington have been so infected with this notion that the U.S. is exceptional that it continued to act the way it has been acting. That's what I call feckless. It's also very reckless, because if they don't realize which end is up here, you know, people trading in rubles now, and it's inevitable what's going to happen with the debt as it is and the balance of payments and everything else. The economic situation is awful. The military situation, however, is something that will have an effect on all this. And when President Putin and President Xi meet in Samarkand just 2 days from now, there will be very important decisions made as to how much support President Xi is willing to give to Putin as Putin reacts to the recent reversals in Ukraine. I fear the worst. I fear escalation untrammeled. And one of the big factors, of course, is that Biden cannot appear to be weak as the midterm elections grow near. And that's just 2 months from now.
Okay. Yeah, indeed. We'll be looking forward to that meeting. So coming down to the wire here in terms of our time, looking at what you said, Fiorella Isabel, about China, I'd like to put that into the context of this BRICS summit that took place, the 14th one, where there was an announcement made by the Russian President Vladimir Putin about the intention to develop a new international reserve currency. Now, that's something that obviously the BRICS countries have entertained, and Brazil actually took it a step further in a sense in its part of the world, where with the presidential candidate at this point, Luiz Inácio da Silva, to have announced a regional currency for those countries there. This idea of regional currency and to trade with currencies that is not the dollar, is that going to further push the whole de-dollarization notion into high gear?
Yeah, so what we're seeing particularly with BRICS countries, right, are once again countries that have been in a situation where they've been completely vulnerable and completely dependent in some ways on the West. And there is a push, as you can see, based on the recent elections that have been happening in Latin America, towards a sovereignty, towards exerting their own sovereignty away from the West, recuperating some of the identity. We saw this with the election of Gustavo Petro in Colombia. We've seen this in Bolivia. We've seen this in Honduras, Nicaragua, Cuba. A lot of these countries are huge allies, including Venezuela, of course, with Russia and also Iran. And so what we're seeing is this push in these BRICS countries and these countries that want to be a part of BRICS as well, that they want to have their own dependency and they want to expand not just with China and Russia, but with their own neighbors. In Latin America, there's like a reemergence of the Bolivarian sentiment from Simon Bolivar, where you know, there was this talk of liberation and democracy. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that definitely is playing a role ideologically, but also economically. It's a lot easier to make connections with your neighbors. And also, of course, when China offers a more equitable economic relationship, they're going to take it.
Thank you so much for that. We're fresh out of time. Fiorella Isabel, political analyst and journalist at the Convo Couch. Thank you. Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. Thank you so much from Raleigh. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until next time.